Chapter 28. Even before he'd disappeared without a trace in the wilds of the Allagash, Pellerin had one hell of a story to tell. As Rhode Island fisherman and insurance fraudster Scott Paradis, he had taken a room at the Valley View Motel. Emmeline Bouchard's establishment in St. Ignace consisted of six separate cabins, each no bigger than a shipping cargo container. It overlooked a broad, braided expanse of the St. John River and the hardscrabble hills of New Brunswick beyond. Pellerin's official report didn't include photographs, but he had sent Kellum a bunch of candids for his case file. I was struck by Emmeline's appearance. She was as curvy and coal-eyed as her daughter, but her hair was tinted magenta and chopped short. There was a hardness to the woman that came through in pictures. The constant presence of a cigarette in her sensuous lips, the tattooed tiger that sometimes peeked above her open-throated blouse, the almost masculine way she stood, booted feet apart. There was something about the photo, taken with the subject's consent, that made me believe Pellerin had found Emmeline sexually desirable. She had certainly been flirting with the man behind the camera. Was that how the investigator had given himself away? By letting his guard down in her bed? It would explain why the keepsake badge had fallen into Emmeline's possession. What it didn't explain was why she'd retained the incriminating item for all these years, knowing that its reappearance might precipitate a felony murder charge against her. The fact that Emmeline was dating or at least sleeping with Pierre Michaud, a man old enough to be her father, must have complicated Pellerin's sexual aspirations. Evidently, her daughter shared the same taste in older men. Once, I would have found the idea of mother and daughter sleeping with father and son shocking, but it wasn't the first instance of pseudo-incestuous behavior I'd come across in my career in the Maine woods, nor even the most extreme. Remote places attract people with forbidden desires. And few places were more remote than St. Ignace. Pellerin had effected his entree into the circle of the Michauds with one of the oldest plays in the investigator's book. He sabotaged his own truck. He then had it towed to the repair shop father and son ran as one of their several businesses. He struck up a conversation with Roland while the latter labored to diagnose the electrical problem. He'd come to St. Ignace, Scott told the Michauds, in the hopes of shooting a monster bear. But he hadn't realized the legal window for killing one over bait, the most effective method, had almost swung shut. Roland Michaud held a commercial hunting guide's license. He offered to take the Rhode Island Rube out for the last days of the season. The next morning, before dawn, Roland swung by the motel to pick up his client. Pellerin appeared with a rifle that must have given the poacher an erection. The investigator had brought with him a brand new GA Precision Gladius, chambered for .308 Winchester cartridges. This scoped camo-colored rifle retailed for more than $8,000. Pellerin claimed he'd bought it after reading the autobiography of famed American sniper Chris Kyle. Pellerin and Kellum had obtained the weapon knowing it would prove irresistible to the Michauds and their associates, that they would fall over each other to use it. And that was indeed what happened. It must have been agony for them not to steal it when they'd killed Scott, but they'd rightly realized the risks were too great. Kellum had found the Gladius at the Valley View awaiting the return of its missing owner. By the end of his initial stay in St. Ignace, Pellerin hadn't shot a bear, but he was regularly riding the gated roads with Roland and Zach Michaud with the sniper's gun and a case of beer, shooting whatever could be shot. One afternoon, Roland used the scoped rifle to pulverize a ruffed grouse at a distance of 100 yards. The bird, Pellerin wrote, exploded into a puff of feathers. His characterizations of the three poachers were highly detailed. Both Roland and Zach Michaud were clones of their father, dark, handsome, bearish men. All the Michauds had extensive rap sheets, misdemeanor assaults, vehicular offenses, multiple violations of Maine's fish and game laws. Zack was the lone felon among them.
He had served a year and a half in the Maine State Prison for a drunk driving crash that had resulted in his female companion breaking her back.
The outsider of the group was John Egan. He, too, was a felon. Under the influence, he'd exposed himself to a troop of Girl Scouts cleaning up litter along the St. John River. The one man whom Pellerin had failed to ingratiate himself with was the primary target, Pierre Michaud. From the start, the ringleader seemed intent on keeping his distance. During his first visit to St. Ignace, the undercover officer didn't have so much as a conversation with the Poacher King. When Pellerin returned to town 2 weeks later, he came bearing gifts. One was a massive cooler stuffed with striped bass on ice. The other was a case of Aguardiente de Medrano, a high-octane fruit brandy of Portuguese extraction popular among commercial fishermen. The choice of the colorless alcohol was smart. It allowed the warden investigator to travel with his own bottle containing water instead of 80-proof liquor. And it was obscure enough to diffuse suspicions. What Maine game warden would show up with 6 bottles of hard-to-obtain, harder-to-pronounce alcohol from Portugal? The first night the Michaud boys tried the aguardiente, they got roaringly drunk and revealed to Pellerin the full extent of their criminal activities. It would not be an exaggeration to say that the Michaud gang had broken half the fish and game laws in the state, but those infractions were only the beginning. They also maintained acres of cultivated marijuana in the forests west of the Allagash Wilderness Waterway and smuggled pounds of it across the St. John River, along with moose and deer meat, into Canada. From the other shore, they brought back prescription narcotics, principally oxycodone, burgled from the homes of cancer patients by their frères criminels across the border. The day after the drinking party, Pellerin received a visit from the Poacher King himself. He returned to his motel from gassing up his truck to find Pierre Michaud waiting in his room. A Desert Eagle handgun lay on the table within easy reach. He was drinking from a mug of King Cole Orange Pekoe. The elder Michaud never drank alcohol in Pellerin's presence. In French, he told Paradis to have a seat on the bed. He then began with a series of personal questions about Pellerin's life, starting with his childhood and leading to the moment when he'd first appeared in St. Ignace. He was a mountain of a man, larger even than his son's. His most noteworthy features were the severe burns on his hands. Pierre had been trained as a blacksmith and kept a smithy behind his house. At some distant time in his past, he had thrust his hands into a fire or had them thrust in by some other man. The skin had melted like beef tallow.
"I want to try out this fancy rifle of yours," Michaud said in the nasal French of the St. John Valley. "We will take your truck."
The thought occurred to Pellerin that he was headed to his own execution. Before they could leave the valley view, however, they were interrupted by the arrival at the motel of the local game warden. Deputy Warden Chasse Lamontagne had been summoned by Emmeline Bouchard to deal with a fictional rabid raccoon. Pellerin realized Pierre Michaud's stratagem. Deputy Chasse had a reputation as the worst poker player at every table, a man incapable of bluffing. If Scott Paradis was an undercover warden, as Pierre suspected, Chasse would be unable to conceal his knowledge of the stranger's identity. To the surprise of both Pellerin and Michaud, Chasse didn't so much as blink when he was introduced to Scott Paradis. His handsome, guileless face revealed nothing except an eagerness to get on with locating the rabid raccoon. Reading between the lines, I could sense Pellerin's disbelief at what had happened. How did he not recognize me? Granted, the two wardens barely knew each other. Chasse Lamontagne was still just a deputy, back when that position was close to a civilian job, a helper to a district warden who needed another set of hands and eyes. Being a warden's assistant had paid peanuts and rarely led to a career in law enforcement. Plus, Pellerin was based out of Division A in the southern part of the state. He had also grown out his hair and beard for the assignment. By some miracle, Pellerin managed to avoid the first pitfall Pierre Michaud had dug for him. But there proved to be more traps set in his path. Next, Pierre had challenged him to shoot that jack-lighted doe Kellum had mentioned. Even then, though, Scott had had the presence of mind to allow himself to be hit in the face by the butt of the rifle as the recoil drove it backward. Pellerin ended up with a bruise on his cheek and a little more of the Michaud's trust. Reading the investigator's account of his actions made me like him even more. He was quick-witted, confident, and gifted with natural situational awareness. No wonder Charlie had loved him like a son. In his report, there were occasional mentions of Emmeline Bouchard, often in the company of Pierre Michaud, and while Pellerin documented crimes committed by the Michaud boys and John Egan, he seemed never to have witnessed the motel owner breaking any law worse than possession of a controlled substance. Once again, I began to wonder if Emmeline Bouchard had been the one who discovered Pellerin's secret and revealed his true identity to Pierre. Maybe the Poacher King had used his girlfriend as bait to gather information from the stranger who had been so quick to ingratiate himself with his sons and so persistent with his questions. Pellerin's report remained unfinished. When I reached the final page, the place where a warden would have included his summary of the investigation, there was only this. Friday, September 27th. Phone call from unknown cell phone at approximately 2100 hours. I received a call from a number I didn't recognize but had reason to believe was one used by the Michauds. The caller did not leave a message. I called the number back and heard an automated tone indicate a voicemail prompt. I did not leave a message. He was never seen or heard from again. Chapter 29. I awoke the next morning to fierce barking. I had fallen asleep rereading Pellerin's report. Instinctively, I reached for the handgun I had concealed beneath the covers. In the process, I managed to send loose pages flying everywhere. I crossed to the window and pulled back the blind. The sun hadn't yet risen. The trees near the house were filled with a gray light that had the diffuse quality of cannon smoke. From what I could gather from his barking, Ferox was still housebound, but something had happened to send him into a state of agitation. Kathy Frost, who had spent decades as a canine handler, had tried to instruct me in the subtleties of dog barks. They use different sounds to communicate aggressiveness, defensiveness, fear, general excitement, she'd said. To my half-educated ears, Ferox sounded less like he wanted to chase a squirrel and more like he'd detected an intruder and wanted to feast on the stranger's beating heart. I pulled the blind wider and saw a sight that made my eyes pop. Edouard was running, naked except for his white underwear, across the clearing between the house and the forest. While I watched, he cast a glance over his shoulder in the direction of the darkened driveway. Then he disappeared from my field of vision into the pines. I dressed, laced up my boots, and tucked my Beretta into its holster under the hem of my shirt.
Kellum shouted for the Cane Corso to shut up.
I'd never heard a dog go so quiet so fast. Next came a door slam. I dearly hoped it was Kellum locking up his monstrous mastiff. I descended the stairs with caution and followed the natural pre-dawn light through the rooms until I reached one of the plate glass windows, looking out at the dooryard draped in shadows. A game warden's patrol truck had rolled to a stop beside my scout. It was one of the older F-150s, so scratched and muddied it was hard to imagine what it looked like washed. The driver stepped out. A tall, straight-backed man dressed in a fatigue green uniform, a black ball cap, and neoprene boots. The ballistic vests patrol wardens wear make even skinny men look fat in the belly, but even wearing body armor, this guy had the physique of a decathlete, Chasse La Montagne. His district lay 50 miles to the north, hard against the New Brunswick border. What was he doing at Moccasin Pond at this hour of the morning? The lieutenant, when he appeared in a t-shirt and pajama bottoms, seemed as surprised as I was.
"What the hell, LaMontagne?" I heard Kellum say through the glass. "I got a message you called." "Why would I have called for you?"
Shas was well into middle age, but like some blonde men, his hair hadn't changed color, and his wrinkles only served to make his features more ruggedly handsome. His natural gaze was a blue squint.
Deputy Dewright could have served as a stunt double for a mid-career Clint Eastwood.
I chose that moment to step outside. Shas didn't so much as blink at seeing me.
"LaMontagne, what are you doing here?"
"It's a mystery to all of us," muttered Kellum. "I didn't call your house, Shas."
"Are you sure?"
"What do you mean, am I sure?"
"The guy who spoke with CJ said he was you. He said, can you tell your dad Stan Kellum needs to see him down at Moccasin Pond?" Kellum ran a hand across his flat top.
"Let's go inside and have coffee and figure this out like civilized men."
In the kitchen, Kellum made us individual cups with one of those pod machines. Shas asked for French vanilla decaf. Stan and I exchanged bemused glances.
"I want to talk to your son," said Kellum.
"He'll be asleep."
"Then wake him the fuck up, Shas. I want to know who's pranking us."
Both Charlie Stevens and Kathy Frost had given me some advice when I was a rookie. I thought it was hard-won wisdom they'd acquired on the job until I happened to read a particular Sherlock Holmes story. There on the page was the idea my mentors had been trying to hammer into my skull. It is a capital mistake to theorize before one has data. Insensibly, one begins to twist facts to suit theories instead of theories to suit facts. So while I wanted to believe that Charlie, the dramaturge, was behind Shas's appearance on stage, I knew not to jump to that conclusion. Venice didn't show herself. Edouard would likely remain in hiding all day. Kellum and I listened as Shas, speaking French, woke up his wife. My grasp of the language was limited, but she didn't appreciate being awakened, nor did she appreciate being asked to wake their son.
"Give me the phone," barked the lieutenant. "Michelle, this is Stan Kellum. I'm sorry to get you up, but I need to speak with your oldest boy. Yes, it's urgent."
While he waited, he addressed LaMontagne, looming in the middle of the kitchen.
"How old is Shas Jr. now?"
21.
"What's he doing for work?"
"Security at the mill."
The just-awakened son came on the line.
"CJ? This is Lieutenant Kellum. Your father is here at my place and said you took a call from someone claiming to be me."
"No, it wasn't."
"Can you remember what this man said exactly? His precise words?" "No, that's fine." "What about his voice?" "Can you be more specific?" "Great. Thanks for your help."
"What did he say?" Shas asked.
"That's one observant boy you've got there," Kellum said. "Tell me something, LaMontagne. You didn't think it was out of the ordinary that I summoned you here without explanation? Or that I called your landline instead of your cell to do so?"
"I assumed you had your reasons."
Kellum sat down heavily at the breakfast table. He cupped both hands around his mug. Finally, he looked up with a scowl in my direction.
"Was it you?
You think I called Shas?
You were reading those files all night. I saw a sliver of light under your door."
"Hell no, it wasn't me," I said. "Why would I even want him here?"
"Because you're a fucking enigma, Bowditch. You always have been. Maybe you read something in the report and decided to pull some mischief to expose us. The little Belgian detective gathers the suspects together."
"What report?" asked Shas, showing an actual flicker of interest.
"Bowditch has decided to reopen the Scott Pellerin investigation for reasons he refuses to share."
"Did someone find something new?"
"I've been reviewing some cold cases," I said, "and St. Ignace is the great white whale." Shas cocked his head the way a baffled dog does.
"What's left to solve?"
Pierre Michaud killed Pellerin. Charlie Stevens shot Pierre as he was trying to get across Beau Lac to New Brunswick. Open and shut. There's the small matter of Pellerin's body never having been found, I said. Shoss leaned against the counter. I always figured Pierre cut him up and burned the pieces in his forge. The blunt brutality of the statement stunned me. Kellum didn't seem surprised or bothered by the callousness of his former subordinate. If that's what's happened, we'll never know, Pierre's property having burned to the ground. I hope you're not planning on poking around St. Ignace, said Shoss. Poking? Why not? There are still people in the valley who are angry about what happened. Game wardens aren't exactly popular. It could be dangerous.
You're still there, I said. It can't be that dangerous.
I grew up in Frenchville. Everyone knows me. They understand I had nothing to do with what happened. I never even knew about the investigation.
It was my decision to bring in Pellerin, said the lieutenant, and my decision not to inform Shoss.
Because he was afraid of Dudley Do-Right blowing his cover? I remembered that section in the report where Emmeline lured Shoss to the motel to see how he reacted when he met the mysterious Scott Paradis. It had been one of Pierre's tests. In his account, Pellerin said that you two met, I said to Shoss. He was baffled that you failed to recognize him. Care to explain that for me? He didn't seem put off by the veiled accusation, but gave a self-deprecating smile and shrugged his wide shoulders.
Honestly, I don't know. I've wondered about it.
CJ was in trouble a lot back then at school. Pellerin had a beard and long hair. I've always been better with names and dates than with faces.
Do you mind if I use your bathroom, Lieutenant?
You know where it is.
Out on the lake, a loon began to yodel. Another answered. Two males, destined for a fight. I waited until I heard the bathroom door close and lowered my voice. I saw Edouard bolt when La Montaigne came down the hill. The poor guy was in his underwear.
He hears a strange noise and assumes it's ice coming to get him.
Kellum lifted the mug and hefted it, almost as if preparing to throw it at me.
There's something you're not telling me about why you're really here. I can't figure out what it is, but I know it's not in my best interest.
Shoss returned to the kitchen looking as guileless as ever.
Can you think of anyone who might have gotten their kick sending you on a wild goose chase?
Kellum asked him. Before Shoss could respond, his phone rang. He looked at the screen.
It's Michelle again.
Allô?
He said.
Quoi? Calmez-tu.
Respire.
Où? Et la police est sûre que c'est elle? Oh mon Dieu, c'est horrible. Si le bureau du shérif appelle à nouveau, dis-le que je me rendrai directement au motel. Je t'aime.
My mother hadn't taught me French, but I had spent enough time with my late grandparents that I could follow the thrust of what he was saying.
What motel? I asked.
The Valley View.
Oh, Christ, I said. Is it Angie Bouchard?
Shoss Lamontagne didn't ask how I knew the name, but his eyes widened from their usual squint. He nodded in the affirmative. A person driving by the motel this morning found her car parked behind the building, out of sight of the road. He recognized it as Angie's. She was inside, dead. Somebody strangled her.
Chapter 30. Stan Kellum erupted at me this time.
You know Emmeline Bouchard's daughter? And you didn't say anything?
I stopped at her house in Presque Isle before I came here. Shoss seemed focused and alert. No longer laid back, he was taking in every word.
Enough bullshit,
said Kellum loudly enough that the dog barked at the far end of the house.
What are you really doing here? It has to do with Stevens, doesn't it? He sent you to spy on me.
Charlie has nothing to do with me being here.
That's a lie.
I bobbed and weaved. He didn't send me.
I earned my master's in the interpretation of body language to detect lying. You're indicating deception all over the place, Bowditch.
then you know how poor even experts are at catching lies. I turned to the sink to rinse my coffee mug. Thank you for the hospitality and the help, but I need to get up to St. Ignace.
Not before you answer my questions.
The state police will want to hear what I have to say.
So use the goddamn phone.
At that moment, the Cane Corso came bounding into the kitchen. The charcoal dog moved into an attack position between his master and me. There was no question in his mind about the enemy in the room. Shas seemed unruffled by the beast's sudden appearance. I need to meet with the detective in charge, I said with as much calmness as I could manage. I would hope you can understand that. The lieutenant's chair toppled as he pushed himself to his feet. The dog showed his teeth when he growled, always the last thing you want to see.
Where is Stevens? Kellum demanded. What is he up to?
A single word from his master might have sent the amber-eyed mastiff leaping at my throat. I honestly don't know.
But he sent you here?
Not directly. What does Charlie Stevens have to do with Angie being murdered? Said Shas. I'd been so distracted by the dog I'd momentarily forgotten the warden was still in the room.
Charlie thinks I lied about what happened 15 years ago, said Kellum. He thinks there might have been some sort of cover-up, so he sent Dr. Watson here to wheedle information out of me. Isn't that right, Mike?
Stan?
Venice stood in the hall between the kitchen and the rest of the house. She was dressed in a linen blouse and denim cutoffs that made her legs look a mile long. I didn't know how long she'd been lurking within earshot, but my gut told me she'd heard everything.
Go upstairs, V, said Kellum.
I told you he would get out if you didn't lock his door.
For an instant, I didn't realize she meant the dog.
Go upstairs.
Why? What's going to happen?
Mike is going to explain what game he's been playing with us.
Or what? You're going to sic Ferox on him?
Mon Dieu!
She dropped her voice.
Ferox, here!
The Cane Corso cast a glance back at Kellum, then clicked across the pine floor to Venice's side.
Platz,
she said. The dog settled down beside her bare feet. He still looked like he wanted a chance to chew on my esophagus, but I was finally able to draw a breath. I owe you an explanation, Stan, I said, and you'll get one. I promise. But right now, I have to go.
What do you think happened, Bowditch?
Shas asked, but there was no menace in his tone. He seemed merely curious. Before I could answer, Kellum said,
He knows Pellerin and I didn't see eye to eye over how to handle the Michauds and wanted to go over my head. He thinks I might have ratted Scott out to Pierre.
The most startling aspect of this confession was that I'd had no such suspicions.
You think the lieutenant was the one who blew Pellerin's cover?
Shas asked, then added a disbelieving smile.
No,
but Kellum hadn't heard me. He glowed with such heat now he looked like he might suffer a heart attack.
The thought that I sold out one of my wardens to the Michauds is obscene.
Stan, you need to take it down a notch, I said.
Don't tell me how to behave in my own house!
Ferox snapped again. Venice hissed at the animal.
Beruhigen! So what else do you suspect me of doing? Said Kellum. You think I drove up to St. Ignace last night, killed Emmeline's daughter for no reason, and booked it back before dawn?
Nobody had a reason to kill her, said Chasse Lamontagne, with surprising passion. She went to high school with my boys. Angie was an innocent girl. Could the man possibly be that naive? The state police need to hear what I have to say, Stan.
I should get back to the valley, too, said Shas. So get the hell out of here, then, the both of you, said Kellum. You have 5 minutes, Bowditch, or I swear to Christ I'm putting the dog on you.
Kellum disappeared as I went upstairs to pack my things. I wished I could have taken those 2 boxes of files with me, but I was already pushing my luck, and the clock was running. Venice, having locked Ferox in what I hoped was a secure room, hung in the doorway. Perhaps her fiancé had told her to watch me in case I tried to steal any documents. The hardness in her eyes made me believe she too felt I had betrayed their trust.
I'm sorry to leave so abruptly. It gives you an excuse to leave without having to explain, no?
I kept my mouth shut.
Stan is not a criminal.
I tried zipping my duffel, but the teeth caught on a shirt I'd stuffed inside.
Would you call him a good man, though?
She straightened her neck as if I'd touched a nerve.
Better than you, I think.
That's a low bar. Tell him I wasn't lying when I said I would explain everything later. She folded her arms below her breasts.
And we should believe you, why?
Maybe you shouldn't. But it's the truth. Then she escorted me through the house and outside into the humid morning. I crossed a spongy patch of stair-step moss that gave beneath my boots, heard the burr of browsing bees, breathed in the good smell of the lake. Shas had already left. As I loaded my scout, I looked back at the lodge and saw Kellum standing rigid behind the plate glass window. He had a corona in his hand, and the Cane Corso was beside him. I drove up the hill until the lake disappeared behind the maples and the spruces and the firs. No doubt Kellum would be on the phone with his old buddies in law enforcement, asking to be updated on the homicide in St. Ignace. He would spend the next hours swilling coronas and wondering what treason Charlie and I suspected he committed that had caused Scott Pellerin's death. When I reached the gate, I found Edouard, now somehow fully dressed, standing at attention beside the steel post like a guardsman. Deerflies buzzed about his sweating skull. I rolled down my window.
Nice meeting you, Edouard.
His mouth became a hard line. It was as if he'd overheard the argument in the kitchen and had chosen to side with his savior, Kellum. When he swung the massive gate shut behind me, the clang of metal on metal echoed inside my skull. Chasse Lamontagne had a 5-minute head start on me. I checked my cell, but now that I was out of sight of Kellum's tower, I had no service. I was praying that whichever state police detective had caught the Bouchard case was someone I knew personally. After my promotion, I'd done meet and greets with detectives around the state, anyone I might consult on future cases. But shaking hands with someone isn't the same as working side by side to solve a crime. As it was, I was going to have a hard enough time explaining the circumstances that had led me to knock on Angie Bouchard's door. Why had she run back to her mother's motel? Who had she gone there to meet? What had she told him? Strangulation is one of the most intimate methods of murder. The perpetrator, except in cases where the victim is a child, is almost always male. Females constitute the overwhelming majority of victims. There is frequently a sexual component. Many rapists strangle their victims so as not to leave behind a witness. Evidence or no, I was willing to go out on a limb and surmise that Angie hadn't crossed paths with a stranger who also happened to be a sexual predator. She had known the man who'd killed her. Maybe she had even sought him out. She'd trusted her killer enough to let him get close. In my memory, I saw Roland Michaud's ursine eyes. Did he kill her for selling the badge and jeopardizing the secrets he'd been keeping for the past 15 years? Lost in thought, I'd failed to notice that I was no longer following Chasse Lamontagne's tire prints. He must have taken a detour. As a native of the county and a patrol warden, he would have known all the backwoods shortcuts. I couldn't afford to attempt a similar maneuver. The dotted squiggles on the map leading to the St. John Valley might be navigable roads in reality. They might also be abandoned skitter trails overgrown with alders and popples, blocked by deadfalls and impassable to all but the skinniest of deer. I stuck to the same route I had taken into the woods. This time, there was an attendant at the Fish River checkpoint. He was a burly man with a bulbous nose and a gauzy white strip tucked into the back of his Red Sox cap. It hung down his neck like the sun protectors on the hats worn by the French Foreign Legion. He came around to my window with a clipboard. A chemical odor emanated from him like an industrial perfume,
Says here you were supposed to be out yesterday, he told me in a booming voice. You got lost, I expect.
Lost? No, I got turned around pretty good, though.
Ah, I ain't gonna charge you for the extra night. Let me open up this sucker for you.
Do you mind my asking a question?
You're wondering about these?
He flicked the gauze dangling from his baseball cap.
Dryer sheets? The bugs hate 'em. I got 'em stuffed all in my clothes. Tonight, I won't have a single bite. Try 'em sometime. You'll thank me for the tip.
A moment later, I was headed back towards civilization. Black flies that had flown in through the window assaulted me behind my ears like tiny heat-seeking missiles. I wondered if there was a laundromat in Portage where I could purchase some dryer sheets. Outside the village, my cell phone exploded with computer-generated musical notes. It was a symphony of buzzing voicemails, dinging texts, and trilling messages. Three of the most recent had come from Stacy.
My mom told me about my dad, she said in her voicemail. And now she can't reach you either. I'm coming up there as soon as I can get a flight. Don't try to argue me out of this, Mike. You know you can't stop me.
Chapter 31. My first call wasn't to Stacy. It was to Danny. She hadn't left me so much as a text message while I'd been in the woods. My hope was that she had slept the whole time. She surprised me by answering.
Ugh,
she said.
What time is it?
Almost 9 o'clock.
Ugh.
I wanted to see how you were feeling.
Like shit,
she said in the same loopy voice she had used the last time.
Hopefully I'll feel better this afternoon. I want to put in a half day.
You're not planning on going to work,
Mike,
was all she said. Do you want to switch over to FaceTime?
So you can tell me how sick I look?
She actually managed to laugh.
No thanks.
Instead of harping on her, I said, a lot's happened since yesterday. The woman who sold that badge to John Smith was murdered last night. Her name was Angie Bouchard. I'd met with her only hours earlier, and I still have no idea where Charlie is. She paused a long time before she spoke again.
How old was she?
24, 25.
Shit.
I brought her up to speed as I turned onto the northbound lane of Route 11, headed for Fort Kent and the Canadian border. I deliberately avoided any mention of the message I'd gotten from Stacy, alerting me of her imminent return to Maine. Given Danny's current state, it seemed a sticky subject. Once again, she listened with uncharacteristic silence. Past Winterville, I swerved unsuccessfully to avoid a pool of still tacky blood. An 18-wheeler must have hit a moose in the night. Afterward, my tires sounded different from the gore stuck to them.
Danny?
I was wondering if you were still there. So, I'm headed to St. Ignace now and need to call the state police. I don't know who's caught the case yet, but I need to tell them what I know.
Maybe it was Shithead.
Who?
Shithead, shit for brains. Maybe he killed her.
John Smith is in jail, Danny. I arrested him for attempted murder, remember?
Yeah, right.
She paused again, and I heard her take several breaths.
I'm gonna get up and take some ibuprofen. Send me a text if something happens.
When was the last time you took your temperature? Her reaction caught me off guard.
Will you lay off me?
I'm worried is all. You said you were bitten by a tick?
It's just the flu.
I'd feel better if someone looked in on you. What she did next almost made me veer into oncoming traffic. She hung up. I pulled into the overgrown lot of an auto repair shop that had closed about 100 years ago and made another call. The scout shuddered every time a big truck whipped past. The phone rang and rang.
Please don't go to voicemail.
I didn't expect to hear from you so soon, said Kathy Frost. I thought you'd still be fishing. Did the bugs drive you out of the woods?
Kathy, I need you to do something for me. It's important. Route 11, between Portage and Fort Kent, is one of Maine's officially designated scenic byways, but I couldn't have described the views that day to save my life. There were lakes with cottages, green hills maybe, rolling fields. My head felt as if it had been shaken like a snow globe. Kathy volunteered to drive out to Danny's house to check on her. After some debate, we agreed against summoning an ambulance, knowing what a proud person my girlfriend was. They lived 2 hours apart, so I wouldn't hear from Kathy soon.
"Maybe you want to cut your fishing trip short," she offered.
"I'm not fishing."
"I know that, Mike. Whatever you're up to, I hope you can justify it."
Danny understands.
She also sounds out of her head.
Next, I called Aura.
"I had to tell her the truth," she said, meaning Stacy.
"She knew something was wrong. She senses things like I do."
"What did she sense?"
"That her father was in danger."
"We don't know that, Aura." She treated my response as not requiring a rebuttal.
"This woman they found dead this morning in St. Ignace. She was involved in this matter Charlie's investigating?"
For a moment, I'd thought Aura's vague premonitions had graduated to witch-level clairvoyance.
"How did you know about it?"
The truth was less sensational.
"The story's been all over public radio this morning."
Of course it would be. "The truth is, I don't know if Angie Bouchard's death is connected to this thing with the badge or not. I suspect it is." I told her about my brief encounter with the murdered woman and her boyfriend. Then I provided an account of my hours in the company of the inscrutable Stan Kellum.
"I never liked him," Aura said with uncharacteristic tartness. "Charlie used to say that Stanley's virtues outweighed his vices, but only by a pennyweight. That arrogant man knows something about Scott's death that he's not admitting. And no, it's not one of my intuitions that makes me say that. It comes from having known Stanley Kellum for 3 decades.
"About Stacy?" I said.
"She's arriving in Bangor tonight. She's going to rent a car and drive here. Tomorrow she's planning on taking Charlie's plane and flying up to the valley."
"That's not a good idea.
Stacy's not the way she used to be, Mike."
"Her rash decision to come up here suggests otherwise."
"Her father is in trouble. I don't have to ask what you would do in that situation because you already know."
She was referring to my rash juvenile behavior when my father had been accused of murder and fled into the forest. It seemed an age ago now, and of course I had no answer for her. How do you rebut the cold, hard truth? Nor could I forget how Stacy had handled the situation in the Big Cypress National Preserve when Buster Lee was bitten by that snake. It wasn't the competence she'd shown treating the man's gory wound. Stacy had always been proficient at more skills than I could count. It was the steady calmness with which she'd handled her terrified patient. If I was no longer the human powder keg I had been at age 24, then how could I say that Stacy Stevens was incapable of personal growth?
"I remembered something else," Aura said. "Scott Pellerin was from Millinocket."
"What?"
"He grew up in Port Clyde before his mother passed, but he was born at the old Millinocket Community Hospital. His mom had family up in the Katahdin region. I don't know if it means anything to you or not."
"More than you can possibly know. Do you happen to have a number for Scott Pellerin's sister in Providence?"
"Yes, I believe so. I'm not sure if it's still current."
"Can you call her and ask what her mother's maiden name was? The question will be easier coming from you than a stranger." Aura, as sharp as her husband, deduced what I was after.
"It's the badge."
"I think so, yes."
For the first time, I thought I understood what the name Duke Dupree meant to Charlie, and why finding his badge on Smith's table had set him off on his heretofore inexplicable quest. Chapter 32. Every morning, as I prepared myself for the day ahead, I would take from my bedside a set of dog tags.
At home, I kept them within easy reach, strung from a deer antler I'd found in the leaf litter near a cabin on Rum Pond. When I'd first started wearing the tags, I had felt intense emotions every time I put them on, often anger, sometimes sadness, occasionally an affectionate nostalgia for an alternate life I'd never lived. The dog tags only weighed 4 grams, but on bad days, they felt as heavy as an anchor chain. Now I wore them out of habit more than anything else. Just a week earlier, leaving for Florida, I had set off the metal detector at the Portland airport because I'd forgotten I was wearing them, let alone why. Now I pulled the tags from beneath my T-shirt and, keeping one hand on the wheel, raised the 2 medallions to a place before my eyes where I could read the name stamped in the stainless steel. Bowditch, John M. My father had been a man whose conscience had atrophied over the course of his life to the point where you doubted he'd ever possessed one. He had been a hard drinker and a womanizer, a poacher and a scofflaw, and in the end he'd become a cold-blooded killer. Jack Bowditch had also been my father, blood of my blood. We looked so much alike you might even say I had been made in his image. The analogy might have been blasphemous, but I wore the dog tags he had brought back from 2 tours in Vietnam the way that certain religious people wear medallions devoted to their name saints. Less in the hope of receiving divine intercessions than out of a sense of spiritual identity. I would never, could never, escape my patrimony. Similarly, the tarnished badge of Duke Dupree had been an icon to his grandson, Scott Pellerin. His sister confirmed to Aura that Dupree was the maiden name of their mother. She verified that his grandfather's badge had been her little brother's most prized possession. When Aura had told me that Pellerin was me, I hadn't appreciated the full extent of our similarities. I understood that Charlie had looked upon him as a troubled young man in need of a surrogate father. What I hadn't realized was that my precursor had been compelled to join the warden service for reasons not unlike those that had driven me to the same decision. I had become a game warden to win my estranged father's respect. I had imagined he would be impressed when I announced my career choice. Instead, he had mocked me for a fool. Scott Pellerin had signed up for similarly misguided reasons. He had wanted to redeem the stained legacy of his maternal grandfather. And so he had carried Duke Dupree's battered badge with him, stashed away in secret as a personal talisman. It wouldn't be the first relic that got a man killed. Fort Kent is the literal end of the road. It is mile zero of Route 1. There is even a marker to commemorate the designation. You have to search hard for the plaque, tucked away in a motel parking lot. I have read there is a similar monument, 2,369 miles south in Key West, Florida, making the same claim to be the start of Route 1. 2 mile zeros. Like most things in life, where you are standing is all a matter of perspective. As I descended the hill above town, I saw the St. John River, broad and blue, and the verdant hills of Canada beyond. In every significant way, the north shore of the river was indistinguishable from the south. And yet, in 1842, an American and a British statesman had decided to draw an invisible line down the middle of the channel, severing a close-knit French-speaking community that had occupied the valley for half a century beforehand. Even now, as I turned onto Main Street, I couldn't help but watch the ring-billed gulls flying carelessly back and forth across the St. John. And I thought about how every border on Earth is a man-made fiction. The birds are never fooled. I made a call to the state police barracks in Holton and spoke with a trooper working a desk. "Who caught the Angie Bouchard case?" "Lieutenant Xanadakis." "Great." The dapper detective was also looking into my run-in with John Smith. I had prayed that the investigator in charge would be someone I knew, not someone who knew me too well.
"Is there anything I can help you with?" asked the trooper in Holton.
"I have some information about the dead woman Lieutenant Xanadakis needs to hear. Where can I find him?"
"In St. Ignace at the Valley View Motel. That's the crime scene. He'll be there until the medical examiner arrives and the evidence techs finish up."
I cruised down a tidy main street that ran parallel to the river, a downtown of brick shop fronts and well-kept clapboard buildings. Instead of following the traffic headed to the customs station at the foot of the bridge to Canada, I left Route 1 and turned onto a road that clung to the south bank of the river. Most people conceive of northernmost Maine as a howling wilderness, but even I, who had visited the valley before, found myself taken aback by the handsome prosperity of Fort Kent. The views were spectacular. The St. John had its headwaters across the border at Lac Frontier in Quebec and drained thousands of square miles on its journey to the tidal tumult of the Bay of Fundy. Here on the border between Maine and New Brunswick, it was a broad, sandy stream with brushy islands in the middle that inevitably would be submerged the following spring when ice floes jammed the river and the streets of lower Fort Kent began to flood. I passed through two villages named for Catholic saints, John and Francis, before I reached a crossroads. It was a T-shaped intersection where a logging road angled away from Route 161 and plunged south into the vast commercial timberland that extended to Moccasin Pond and another 500 miles beyond that. My atlas gave the name of this hamlet as St. Ignatius, but to the French speakers of the valley, it had always been St. Ignace. Now it was mostly just ruins. Along the riverside, a row of charred foundations were all that remained of the houses and business that had burned the night the Maine State Police and the Maine Warden Service had come looking for Scott Pellerin. Sumacs, poplars, and assorted small bushes had grown up from the rubble, but all that fresh green life couldn't hide the violence that had happened 15 years before. The fact that the fire that had claimed half the village had been the fault of Pierre Michaud, covering his tracks, wasn't visible in the devastation. I came to a stop. The first drops of yet another rain shower fell upon my windshield. The hot engine hissed. Across the road from the ruins stood a general store, closed and for sale. A grange hall that didn't appear to have hosted a meeting in decades, and a clapboard house with a sunken roof that looked to be one good blizzard away from collapsing. Two trucks, three ATVs, and a dooryard walled with stacked firewood told me the dwelling was occupied. I dug out the snapshot of Pierre Michaud and held it at arm's length with the overgrown ruins of his former home in the background. Who was this man? What had he been thinking when he rigged his house with gasoline-drenched blankets, propane tanks, and canisters of acetylene? How did he imagine he could escape with 100 police officers on both sides of the border searching for him by land, water, and air? He must have known that Beau Lac, 20 miles north along a tributary river, was a soft spot in the invisible fence. The wardens found a dirt bike he had ridden there and dumped into the water. Locals said Pierre had kept a canoe chained to a tree on the lake. He had family on the other side. A Canadian relative might have been waiting to pick him up. But he never made it across. My imagination easily conjured the scene. A full moon appearing and disappearing behind ragged clouds. A man paddling for his life across water black as spilled ink. And then, out of nowhere, a float plane. The pilot spots the fugitive. The plane descends. It skates on its pontoons across the surface until it is within 30 yards of the canoe. Gunshots follow. The fugitive leaps into the 40-degree lake, believing he can outswim death. He miscalculates. My friend had kept the picture of this evil, bare-faced man in the same box as his war medals. Charlie Disdain trophies. I thought I understood the meaning of the snapshot now. It was a reminder of a failure he wouldn't allow himself to forget. and the Hindu inscription on the back? A spell, to ward off the furies who assailed his conscience by night. As I put away Pierre's picture, I saw through the rain the shape of a person in a lighted window in the house across the road. Then the curtain fell. I could have knocked and asked to know what happened here 15 years earlier, but I already knew the answer I'd receive. Silence. I engaged my wipers to clear the glass. I pushed the transmission into first gear and began creeping forward again. Less than a mile down the road, I came to the Valley View Motel. The sign rising from the side of the road was a charming patois. Bienvenue, Valley View Motel, Chambre Rénovée, Welcome Sledders. Snowmobile season had ended 3 months earlier, but from the boarded windows of the cabins, it was obvious the motel had been closed a lot longer than that. This morning, the parking lot overflowed with visitors. The state police, the Aroostook County Sheriff's Office, even the Fort Kent Police Department had sent representatives as had the U.S. Border Patrol. The proximity to Canada, just a rifle shot across the river, must have engaged the interest of the feds. I parked along the roadside, grabbed my raincoat and warden cap, and made my way up the string of vehicles. I passed Chasse LaMontagne's warden truck. It was even muddier than before. The bastard had taken a shortcut and beaten me here. A deputy charged with shooing away nosy neighbors and blocking reporters when they arrived tried to stop me until I showed him my badge. A crowd of officers milled outside the tape barrier. Standing off to one side was Chasse LaMontagne. He had his back to me, but his height and wingspan made him impossible to misidentify. The warden was on his phone speaking to someone in French. It sounded like an argument. I slipped past before he recognized me. I found Nico Xanadakis in conversation with a man in blue coveralls, one of his evidence technicians. This morning, the dapper detective was wearing a black trench coat. Beneath it was a charcoal blazer with a gray shirt, a black satin tie, and a silver pocket square. Also nitrile gloves to keep from contaminating evidence. He smelled of eau de cologne and DEET. Bowditch? His tone was not welcoming. I have information about Angie Bouchard you need to hear. Of course you do. It would be best if we speak in private. He dismissed the technician and extended an arm toward the motel dumpster. Someone had deposited the carcass of a road-killed deer inside it, and the air was alive with the buzzing of flies and the stomach-turning stench of rotting flesh. We retreated to a safe distance. Xanadakis was neither the best nor the worst detective in the state police. He could connect puzzle pieces when he had a pattern to work from. This has something to do with what happened at Hook Lake, your confrontation with Smith. For the first time, I had an unimpeded view of the back lot. Angie's Volkswagen, dirty with pollen paste, was parked in the far corner. Evidence techs had opened the doors to shoot videos and photographs. I met with Bouchard yesterday at the house she was renting in Presque Isle. Xanadakis raised an eyebrow. Go on. Her boyfriend was there. Roland Michaud, son of Pierre Michaud. I'm sure that name rings a bell. You need to start with Roland. No, I need to start with you. What the fuck have you been doing up here? First you visit an amateur fence who tries to kill you, then you drop in on a girl who turns up dead. I wasn't entirely forthcoming when you and I spoke at Hook Lake. You lied, you mean? By omission. I'm not your fucking priest, man. I don't care about categories of sin. I care about being misled by an officer who swore an oath to uphold the law. Did you think I wouldn't find out it was Charlie Stevens who beat the piss out of Smith? How is the old man mixed up in this? Smith had a warden badge for sale along with his other stolen stuff at the Machias Dyke. He raised the collar of his trench coat against the piss-warm rain. Ed Stevens took offense? The badge belonged to a warden named Duke Dupree. I don't know him. He died a long time ago. His grandson was Scott Pellerin. His response was terse but to the point.
Fuck me. This is all connected to that clusterfuck in St. Ignace?
The reason I didn't tell you at Hook Lake was because I didn't know who Dupree was or that the badge had anything to do with Pellerin's disappearance. For all I knew, Charlie had just gone off on Smith because he was a scumbag.
The pomade in his wavy hair caused the water to bead up. So where did Smith say he came by the thing?
He bought it from Angie Bouchard at a yard sale.
Scott Pellerin stayed at this motel when he was undercover. Angie's mother, Emmeline, owned and ran the place then. My guess is that Pellerin had his grandfather's badge with him, maybe as a good luck charm, and Emmeline discovered it. She was divorced and dating Pierre Michaud at the time. No one knows how Pellerin's cover was blown, but my current thinking is the badge might have played a part.
Was any of this confirmed by Angie Bouchard?
No, but the fact that she had it in her possession suggests a connection.
How did she react when you confronted her with this theory of yours?
I didn't confront her with anything. I just asked her where she'd gotten the badge. She lied and said it belonged to her roommate, but I am pretty sure she found it among her late mother's belongings and didn't know what it was.
Did she say anything about coming back up here?
No.
So you might have spooked her?
The possibility had occurred to me.
Yes.
Xanadakis didn't have to state the obvious. That if I had never shown up on her doorstep, she might still be alive.
Do you have the badge?
Rain pattered off the brim of my cap.
No.
He seemed taken aback by this.
Where is it?
Charlie has it.
And where's Charlie?
That's the million-dollar question. Before he could press me on the point, I decided the time had come to shift the discussion.
You need to bring in the state police detectives who worked the Pellerin case. I think Angie's death is connected to what happened to Scott. I think you're looking for the same killer or killers. At the very least, the Pellerin case needs to be reassigned to the Unsolved Homicide Unit.
Xanadakis raised a gloved finger under my nose.
Bowditch? You might think I don't recall the circumstances of how we met, but I do. Those drug dealers whose car got stuck in the woods during a snowstorm? You had a theory then, I remember. It was wrong, wasn't it?
Not entirely.
Right now, I need to focus on the physical evidence. Conspiracy theories can wait.
It's not a conspiracy theory, I said.
Not in the paranoid sense, I mean. There are actual conspiracies.
Do you practice being such a...
Bring in Roland Michaud, at least, I said.
Why?
I saw Angie and him together at her house. He was half-dressed. Strangulation is an intimate way to kill someone, and he has connections to Pellerin's disappearance.
The detective took a moment to chew on this.
Maybe she cheated on him, or he cheated on her. Things got violent. It makes more sense than her being murdered over some old badge.
I'd like to see her, I said.
I'm sure you would.
I saw her alive less than 24 hours ago. I don't know how many witnesses you have who can speak to that period of time. I might notice some detail that helps your investigation.
What does it hurt to let me look?
Arrogant he might be, but Nico Xanadakis was no fool. As long as he got credit for clearing the case, he would exploit anyone and anything that might serve his purpose. He brushed water off his greased hair.
All right, but you'd better not vomit on my crime scene.
We started in the direction of the Volkswagen, but the detective came to a quick stop and spun around. Chasse Lamontagne was following us. How long had he been standing within earshot?
Where are you going? Asked Xanadakis.
His statuesque head was unprotected from the elements. The rain just slid down his nose and cheeks.
I knew Angie, too. I thought it could be helpful. Did you see her in the past day?
No.
Then you can leave. Get back to checking fishing licenses or whatever. I'll call you when I require your expert assistance.
Chasse nodded.
I'll keep my phone on.
You do that. As the warden walked off, he patted his pockets until he found his cell. I kept an eye on him. Soon he was arguing with the person on the other end again. I wondered who could have made him so mad.